Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Henry Lewis Wallace terrorized Charlotte, North Carolina, from May 1992 to March 1994. Wallace preyed on lower economic class black women between 75 and 35 years old. He knew most of his victims, some through his job at Taco Bell, and gained their trust with his friendly demeanor and gentle nature, concealing a monster fueled by drug abuse and rage against women. A rarity in that he was an African-American serial killer, his murderous rampage spurred controversy throughout the city. Community members accused local police of ignoring the murders because of the victims' race. Wallace attended the funerals of many of his victims and offered condolences to families. The ensuing investigation became the largest in North Carolina's history. Wallace was eventually found guilty and convicted of 9 counts of murder, but he admitted to more killings while incarcerated. He is potentially responsible from anywhere from 20 to 90 deaths of black women. Wallace continues to appeal and awaits his execution at Central Prison in Raleigh. Bad Henry, the murderous rampage of the Taco Bell Strangler by Ron Chepsiak, offers valuable insight into the psychology of serial killers and sheds light on issues surrounding race and policing. The book that we're featuring this evening is Bad Henry, the murderous rampage of the Taco Bell Strangler, with my special guest, journalist, author, and filmmaker, Ron Chepsiak. Welcome to the program and thank you very much for this interview, Ron Chepsiak.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Let's talk right away about the bad beginning of Henry Wallace. And you talk about his mother, Lottie, and that Henry's father walked out on Lottie when she was pregnant and it made her bitter, and she would viciously take out her frustrations on her children. Tell us about Lottie and Henry Wallace's childhood upbringing.
Yeah. Lottie was his mother, and she had a pretty tough life. You have to say that for that. She worked in a textile factory. She didn't have much success with men. She had a boyfriend named Parker that actually Henry really liked, but he left her because he was married and he thought that it wasn't, after a while, he had second thoughts about having an affair with a woman when he was married. So he walked out and that sort of stuff. And she tended to take her frustrations and her anger out on her children. Henry had a sister named Yvonne, and they lived in a really, really incredibly poor, I guess you'd call it a building. It was like a shack.
Right.
And there was no indoor plumbing. His mother made him carry out buckets of feces, which they kept in his bedroom, by the way. And she would get frustrated and she would have Henry and Yvonne beat each other up.
Yeah.
You know, and she dressed him up in a girl's clothes and let him go out into the neighborhood. And so, you know, Henry had this incredibly traumatic background. And then the top off all of that, he was abused, sexually abused by some of the younger girls in the neighborhood. But he ended up going to school and being very normal. Like, everybody liked him. You know, he ended up on the student council. He was a cheerleader. There was like 15 cheerleaders. I talked with one of them who was shocked when she found out that Henry was a serial killer. She said he was one of the nicest guys she'd ever met. You know, he drove the bus for the students, and he was a confidant. A lot of the cheerleaders, you know, for the cheerleaders, you know, he listened to their complaints about their boyfriends, and he advised them on certain things in life. And he was very popular. All of this, I guess, was building in him, and it was creating a rage within him that eventually it would explode, and he would take it out on some of the women that he came in contact with throughout his life.
You talk about his mother, and his mother had maybe for the time, a strange reading. Some of her reading material could be considered strange.
Oh, yes. True Detective magazines. You know, that came up in the trial, the True Detective magazines, and they made a lot of that. Of course, not everybody that reads True Detective magazines ends up as a serial killer. So that was kind of controversial. But some of the psychologists try to connect it to Henry's problems.
Now, you talk about him in school, and despite his poverty, you say that and this trauma from his childhood, people didn't see that. And he was a friend and a confidant to people, and he got along, and he was considered over and over again as charming.
Yeah. Yeah, so, he's a very, very nice guy.
So tell us about his entry into the Navy and more about what happened in high school and the kind of grades he got and his behavior that he exhibited.
Well, he was pretty normal in high school. He was, pretty average. He had good enough grades to get into college. He wanted to go to Winthrop College. That, ironically, that's the place where I worked as a professor for several years, but his mother didn't want him to go. And so he stayed closer to home on that. And he decided to go into the Navy about 1985, and actually his career was pretty good. He was involved with petty crime, and when he was out on the West Coast in Seattle, he got caught for shoplifting and had a 2-year suspended sentence, and he had probation officer that sort of supervised him, and he said he never came into the meetings at all. And it was sort of like the lack of accountability in Henry's life, which would follow him and allow him to do a lot of the crimes that he did.
You talk about the college that he wasn't advised to go by his mother, but he did attend college for a time. What happens after college?
He got a job as a disc jockey for Barnwell Radio Station. He did very good. The woman seemed to like his soft, soothing voice. He went to college, and then he married his high school sweetheart in 1985, a woman named Maretta Bradham, who had her own problems. She was raped and had sexual problems, which I discussed in the book a little bit in there. And then he went into the Navy, and that's when he started to use drugs. You know, that's when he started to use cocaine. He had already started to drink. He said in one of his reports for the psychiatrist that he was drinking like 16 to 18 beers a day.
Wow.
In his teens, but I think it's got a little bit overstated. I don't think anybody could drink that much liquor and still be functioning on that sort of thing. But anyways, he began to use drugs, and that started to lead to the crime, the petty crime. Yeah, he was involved with several burglaries in and around the Seattle metro area, and was arrested, of course, like I said, breaking into that hardware store. And he pled guilty to second-degree burglary. A judge sentenced him to 2 years supervised probation on that.
Now, you talk about his marriage breaking up, and they were separated but never divorced, but they were separated, you say, by 92.
Yeah.
At one point, he goes to live with his sister, Yvonne, who he was always close with.
Yeah, in Rock Hill, the city where I'm living right now, yeah, which is a suburb of Charlotte. It's about 30 miles from downtown Charlotte, where I'm living on that. And he already committed his first murder. He committed his first murder in Barnwell. There was a woman named Deshonda Bethea, and she was 18 years old, and she was a high school student. And Wallace had a thing for her, and he kept bugging her about getting together and all that. And they finally ended together. And then he put the move on her, and he asked her, you know, he backed off when she got a little frightened, and he asked her if she was going to report it. And she made a mistake of saying, yeah. So he ended up killing her, and he strangled her and threw her body in the water. And he should have been charged, because he was one of the last people seen with him. And I talked to a couple of the cops that investigated that case. And they said they knew he did it, but they had no way of proving it. on that. So that was his first escape from the law, so to speak.
That first crime, the forensics experts, you write, checked his car and they found absolutely nothing.
Yeah, he was very smart. He always cleaned up the scene of fingerprints and all that. As he went through life and was killing, his drug use increased and he got more careless later on. And that's what really did him in. They did find his palm prints on a car trunk, which was part of the evidence that they presented against him and actually led to his arrest.
You write about back to Bethea that she was found a couple of weeks later in the water. And a detective commented that water does terrible things to DNA.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Henry Wallace was aware of ways to make sure that he was not apprehended.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, he was a born criminal. You know, he really understood the physiology of crime. And he knew, like, you know, for example, later on, he killed one woman and he put the temperature down so that it was cooler. And that would sort of slow the body from decomposing.
Yes.
So that would throw off the timing when the crime was committed.
You write about March 31st, 1990, and that there was a woman named Eartha Brown, a 16-year-old, and she's a friend of DeShanda Bethea. And she had reported to police that he had put a gun to her head and tried to rape her. What happens from that report to police?
Nothing. Nothing. He was actually suspected of killing a woman in Allendale County and attempting rape of another one. And he was also suspected of raping another woman in Barnwell County. And nothing happened. Nothing really happened. And what he did was he stayed one step ahead of the law. His marriage was failing. He got fired from his job because he was stealing. And he ended up, you know, murdering this woman. And so what he did with that, that's when he went to Rock Hill, South Carolina. He decided to get out of Dodge and he left the city.
You write that Charlotte is one of the fastest growing cities in America. And with it comes a dramatic increase in crime. You cite some statistics about the difference in 3 years between murders, 42, and 3 years later, over 100. So that's what this police department was dealing with in this area. And also, you write about the lack of detectives and the lack of people sharing information, even at that time.
Yeah, it was a fast-growing town, but they still had a small-town attitude. And the city government really wouldn't increase the police force or give them the resources that they needed. And top it off, there was crack. Crack was sweeping the country. Right. And that was leading to a really surge in crime. And the detectives that they had on the force, there was like 7 detectives that were supposed to handle all of these murders, which were increasing. And so it was a perfect background for a guy like Henry Wallace to begin committing his crimes.
You write about May 1992 and a Sharon Nance, a 33-year-old.
Yeah.
She has some police record for drugs.
Yeah, that was kind of disputed, but I think it was pretty accurate.
She is found beaten to death. And again, the police find little forensic evidence and have no clue. In fact, Sharon Nance's death was never classified as a murder, even.
That's right. She was found a few days later, and he just left her on the side of the road. And that was it. You know, nothing ever happened. There was no follow-up, no real investigation and all that. That, of course, gave him growing confidence that he could get away with murder, so to speak. And that's what he did. I mean, one of the things that we see is that, you know, he would commit a crime and he realized like how outrageous it was. And he would go home and wait for a report on the news, on the television news, and nothing happened. There was no report, nothing. And so that sort of encouraged him, you know, made him a little bit overconfident as well, that he could get away with murder.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You say he felt invincible, and also a very important thing happens in terms of he moves in with a woman named Sadie McKnight.
That was his girlfriend, and Katie McKnight had a friend called Caroline Love, who became his second victim in Charlotte. And he took her body from the house and he dumped it on an abandoned road. And it took 2 years for her to be discovered on that. And it's interesting because Carolyn Love lived with McKnight, and they were concerned when Carolyn Love disappeared. And Henry was there. You know, he was talking with them, sympathizing, speculating. And they all went down to the police station to file a missing persons report. Henry did that with them on that. And it wasn't until he was caught later on that Caroline Love's body was discovered.
You write that Love was the third woman to go missing in Charlotte.
Yeah, there were a couple of other mystery women and all that. And they found, I think, one of the other ones. But it was showing that there was a beginning of a crime problem happening in Charlotte. And then the police were really clueless about what was going on.
Now, you introduce Shauna Hawk, a 20-year-old, her mom, Dee Sumter, and Walter Hawk Jr. They all lived together. And she worked at the nearby Taco Bell. And, of course, Henry Wallace was the manager. He had hired her. He had known her for 5 or 6 months, you write. And they became good friends and even dated.
And her mother liked him.
Yeah.
You know, I interviewed her, and she said that, you know, Wallace had completely fooled her. And she dated for a while. And yeah, he ended up, I think it was an impulse murder. He decided to just kill her. And he did that. He strangled her, put her in the water, washed her body, get rid of the evidence, and left her. And the family was concerned. She was supposed to pick up a nephew, I believe. And she had disappeared. She had left her purse at home, which is not very unusual, Dee Sumter said. And they didn't realize that all the time that they were looking, they were calling everywhere. Her body was in the bathroom of their house. And Daryl finally went looking through the house and he discovered the body in the bathtub, her eyes open, and she was naked and she was dead on that. And in this case, Wallace actually showed up at the funeral.
Yes.
Yeah, he went to the funeral and he looked kind of weird. Everybody was saying that he was really weird. He was sitting in the back, you know, like just staring ahead. Nobody, of course, knew that it had anything to do with her death.
In fact, Dee Sumter considered him possibly a suspect, but then after seeing him at the funeral, she thought he looked so concerned sitting there by himself, overwhelmed, maybe even looking a little weird.
Yeah.
But also that she had seen him another time, and it just, in her mind, there was no way that Henry was responsible.
Well, she actually saw him at a mall, and he walked up to her and said, "I'm very, very sorry, Miss Sumter, for the death of your daughter. We all liked her, and we're very sorry to see her go." I mean, this guy was incredible actor. And
yes,
she suspected that it had to be somebody that knew Shauna, because there was no forced entry, nothing. And so she put all of the guys that her daughter knew through her mind, and she came across Wallace, and she sort of said, "Wallace, no. Henry, no. Sweet Henry, no." And she just sort of put it out of her mind that he would have anything to do with her daughter's murder.
A friend thought Dee needed a new purpose, and so they formed an organization, Mothers of Murdered Offspring.
Right, MAMO.
Yeah, so she set forth to be able to do something on behalf of her daughter, this new purpose to be able to find the killer and to make some changes she felt were necessary in the police force moving forward.
She was really devastated by her daughter. She was really close to her daughter. And she was really devastated and she wasn't getting over it. And this is like a month later, and her friend Judy Williams said, "You got to get over this, you know." And she talked her into forming this organization to help other people that had offspring murdered. And that began the organization. And it's still in operation today and still thriving. Although Dee has stepped aside, she's not really associated with the organization anymore.
Now, you say that, of course, Henry Wallace's crack problem is getting to the point where can't hold down work, but he's also just needs more money and he needs to resort to theft. And he can only think of his friends for a source of things to steal from. And then you introduce Aubrey Spain, 24-year-old, a manager at Taco Bell. And she also hung out with Henry and also Shauna Hawk. She was also friends with Shauna Hawk as well.
Right.
Now, this is June 24th, 1993. He turns up at her apartment and they had been friends and they would go out often.
Yeah.
What happens at her home? What does he say to her? How does he react?
It was an impulsive murder. And one of the things that he did, he had a technique called the Boston choke, where he would put his hands around their neck and strangle them. And he waited for them to turn around when they're totally unsuspecting. And then he would apply this technique. And that's what he did. He applied that to her. And of course, he raped her. I don't think that the rapes were essentially lust. I think it was rage, you know, against the woman that he had killed on that. And he left the place and got away with it. You know, nothing happened. Yeah, this time the police were not really connecting any of these cases. All these cases happened within a 5-mile area, by the way, which is not a large space, you know, where you have these murders being committed. But each of the cases that were happening, the police were handling individually. Mm. And evidently, they didn't really make a connection between the various cases. They never talked about it, which sounds incredible. But that's what that was the case. And there was only 7 of them. And like I said, the murders were increasing. You know, as you pointed out, you know, they were increasing substantially over the early 1990s.
You write that nothing had happened to Henry after he had killed his first, incredibly, 5 victims in Charlotte, and his arrogance grew. And then you introduce Valencia Jumper, and they had been friends. She'd been friends with Henry for over a year, and she came to attend C. Smith College, majoring in computer science.
Yeah, she was very ambitious. Her parents were very proud of her. She came to Charlotte, and for some reason, Henry changes his method of killing. He tried to set her on fire to cover up his crime. And she was also a friend of his sister's, and which was really amazing. And but anyways, he tried to set her on fire, and the coroner misdiagnosed the crime. He said it was accidental fire, which was quite amazing. And so he got off the hook, you know, no accountability.
Yeah, incredible.
And he went to a funeral. He went to Valencia's funeral, and he even sent the family condolences. So, you know, no one suspected anything about this guy. You know, this guy was a regular, they all thought he was a regular nice guy, which is kind of frightening. When I was writing this book, I was saying, holy mac, I said, there must be other people out there like this that can operate at this level, you know, this murderous level and get away with it.
Yeah, it takes psychopathic mindset to even a different level.
Yeah.
When it's not strangers, it's people you really know and are friends with you and trust you. You introduce Michelle Stinson, 20-year-old. And it's interesting, she talks about, or she had experienced and met Henry when she was pregnant, and he had helped her. He was very helpful. He had taken the child out of daycare. He was a very helpful person when she needed him most.
And she worked with him at Taco Bell. You know, she worked with, this is another example of the connection to the crimes, you know, like Shauna Hawk, she worked at Taco Bell, and he raped her, and then he strangled her and stabbed her in front of her own son, you know, her eldest son, which was quite amazing, quite chilling.
What I was going to say, too, is that we didn't gloss over it, but there's all of these cases where these people are killed in their homes. It takes a little bit for people to discover their bodies, and it's usually family members that have to uncover this horrifying scene. It's very interesting when a neighbor comes in, sees that Michelle Stinson is on the floor, and weirdly enough, her two young sons are calmly just watching the television set.
Yeah, yeah, and Henry never touched them, which was quite remarkable.
You write that the Charlotte police asked finally the FBI for help. What was the FBI's response?
They weren't really helpful. They didn't think there was a serial killer involved. And a gentleman named Ressler, very prominent FBI agent, said if Wallace was trying to be a serial killer, he was going about it all wrong. And they just never really helped. Mm-hmm. So the Charlotte police were on their own, you know, trying to figure out what was going on.
You write that on February 4th, 1994, Wallace is arrested for shoplifting. And it's very close to where the bodies were discovered, the dump sites.
Yeah, and they never made a connection between him and any of the murders on that. And the thing I found out is that all this information was in a central database. Mm. If the cops would have checked the database, they would have found all this stuff on Henry Wallace: suspicion of murder, the shoplifting charge, his crimes in Seattle when he was in the military, on all that. But for some reason, they never checked his database.
You introduce Sergeant Gary McFadden. He's an African-American. And he is appointed to lead the investigation. So there is some political pressure. There is incredible pressure from the public on the police to do something. Gary McFadden is appointed. And they also wanted to put, it seemed, a black officer in the head of this to stem the criticism that they weren't doing enough because the victims were black.
And Gary recognized this, too. He called himself a scapegoat. You know, so if the investigation continued to be screwed up, he would get the blame for it. And he was a black officer. So they could say, you know, look, we appointed a black guy and nothing has changed on that. So you can't blame us. on that, but he was very competent. And he eventually, you know, he had a lot of conflict with Dee at first because she thought Dee Sumter, Shauna Hawke's mother, because she thought that the police were very slow on the investigation. And she was right. I mean, they weren't doing anything really. She told me about an officer that said, look, Miss Sumter, I'll keep you informed and all that sort of stuff. And I'll get in touch with you if we have anything. And he never did call her, you know, on that then, which led to her frustration. And she became sort of the face of the of these growing series of crimes. She tried to keep it in the public eye. She wrote a open letter to the killer, which, of course, is Henry Wallace, which appeared in the press, telling him to give himself up, you know, and what he was doing was really wrong. And he's messing up a lot of lives and that he should really give himself up. And nothing, of course, happened out of that.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear from our sponsor. Ladies, I have some interesting information for you. There was a U.S. federal law where women were excluded from clinical research policy until 1993. Ritual conducted a university-led clinical trial for their Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin to assess its efficacy. The results were that vitamin D levels increased by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in just 12 weeks. My wife Lisa started with Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus, and I started soon after with Ritual Essential for Men 50 Plus. Just based on the research that Ritual had undertaken to develop their multivitamin. It's been a few years now for her and almost as many for me, and we both continue to rely on Ritual multivitamin. This multivitamin is made with high quality and traceable key nutrients in clean, bioavailable forms. With 9 key nutrients in 2 capsules per day, their unique Bedlettan oil capsule technology is even patented. Essential for Women 18 Plus is one of the few women's multis that's USP verified, meaning what's on the label is what's in the formula. It's also soy-free, gluten-free, vegan-friendly, and formulated without GMOs. Ritual is all about hot data and stone-cold facts. Get to know your nutrients on a deeper level with 20% off during your first month. Visit ritual.com/murder to start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today. Now, this rampage continues. February 1994, you introduce Vanessa Little Mack, and she has 2 daughters, and she works at the Carolina Medical Center. And Henry had invited her on a date. That went okay. They had a second date, July 93, and she invited her sister, Leslie. And you write that he became like a brother to Vanessa Mack.
Yeah. And of course, you know, she didn't suspect anything when he ended up at her apartment in West Charlotte. And again, unsuspecting, she turned around. Now, he was a big guy, too. He was like 6'1". Mm-hmm. At one point, when he was in prison, he weighed 300 pounds, but he was normally like 240 pounds.
Yeah.
And of course, these were small women. So he was pretty powerful. And he ended up strangling her. And then raping her and strangling her and leaving the apartment.
You write that police, and like many of these other crime scenes, they said there was no forced entry. So again, police could surmise that the victim knew the killer.
Yeah. And you would figure that they would check the backgrounds to find out if there was any connection. And finally, they did. Gary McFadden asked some of the people that knew the victims, like, who would she invite? Who would she led into her apartment unsuspectingly on that then. And he asked several people, and the only person that really showed up on all the lists was Henry Wallace.
You write, March 9th, 1994, Vernus Lamar Woods was in his apartment. He was friends with Henry Wallace, but he also lived with his girlfriend, Brandy Henderson, who was 18 years old, and they had a 10-month-old son named Tyrese. Now, tell us about this, where Henry goes to the apartment and Woods is taking care of Tyrese, and how it comes that he meets Betty Buckholm that day.
What happened was he went to the apartment. He was intent on getting money. He was desperate now. His girlfriend, Sadie McKnight, was fed up with him and his drug habits, and she kicked him out, and he had begged her to come in. He hadn't washed for a while. He had sold a lot of his personal possessions, and he was really hurting for a fix, you know, for a crack fix. Mm. He was going to go. He decided that he, who did he know? So he decided that that Brandy Henderson would be his next victim. And he went to her house and Squeaky Woods was there. And he didn't expect that. And so that threw him off. And he had to leave, make an excuse and leave the apartment. He just said that he was leaving town and he just wanted to come by and say hello to him, say goodbye to him before he left. And so he left that apartment and he said, well, else did he know in the neighborhood? He really needed the money and all that. And he ended up figuring that Betty Baucom lived somewhere in that area. And finally, he figured out where she lived and he went to see her. And Baucom and Wallace's girlfriend were co-workers at Bojangles, where she was an assistant manager. And he thought that she would have some money or she would have access to the safe at Bojangles. And he put pressure on her and ended up murdering her. He took considerable amount of valuables from her house. And then he left the apartment with her car and he pawned everything except the car. And that is where it started to get weird, because he had her ATM card and he went to the ATM, and the cops eventually got the ATM videotape, and they couldn't see Wallace, but they recognized an earring on one of his ears. And that was part of the identification, which led to his eventual arrest.
You say, though, that he's in the midst of this rampage. He's paranoid. He's desperate. He has nowhere to live, nowhere to go. And he goes back to the Woods apartment and Brandy Henderson.
Yeah. And then he decided for some reason to go back. And of course, she was unsuspecting. He knew that Bernice Woods would be at work. And so he showed up on that and he eventually murdered her too as well.
You write that he demanded money. She said she only had $15. She said, can I hold my son? He said, that's not a good idea for what we're going to be doing. And he told her to take off her clothes and she started praying. And he said to her, despicably, of course, I'm not going to hurt you. I got what I wanted and I'm leaving. And he asked her for a hug and she did. And then, of course, in his trademark fashion, he goes to the washroom and gets a towel to be able to use to choke her. And so she asks, though, she grabs her son at some point and lays him across her chest and turned his head so he couldn't see what was happening. And meanwhile, he uses his towel around her neck till her eyes are bulging out and she's red in the face. And he strangles her dead and puts her clothes on.
And the child started making noise and he tried to shut up the kid and almost strangled it to death on that. And then he left the apartment.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. He puts a towel around the kid's throat to silence the kid, not knowing whether he's going to strangle him to death. He leaves him there. The door is ajar. And then, of course, Lamar comes home and has this horrifying. The first thing he sees is his son struggling to breathe. And then, of course, discovers Brandy on the ground. Incredible scene.
But by this time, he was totally out of control. Wallace was, and he was desperate because he was killing these people and not getting money. He ended up one last victim, Deborah Ann Slaughter, and he was a co-worker of his girlfriend, Sadie McKnight. And this shows you how out of control he was. He ended up stabbing her something like 38 times in the stomach and chest on that, and he left the apartment. But by now, the police were intensifying paroles in East Charlotte. They were taking the case much more seriously. They got on to Wallace with the palm print on Betty Baucom's car. You know, he had wiped everything off except that he had to close the trunk, and he forgot that he didn't have gloves on, and he closed the trunk, and that led to a palm print, which police were able to analyze, and they connected to Wallace. And then the police, like I said, were really understaffed, and they had a backlog of rape kits. And finally, some of the victims were tested for DNA, and they found some of it related to Wallace on that. And they discovered that he had been arrested for shoplifting a $38 shirt out of a shop. And they used that as the excuse to go out and arrest him. And then they found him at an apartment of a friend hiding in the bathroom. And they arrested him and brought him in.
Right away, you write about this questioning. And right away, detectives, including McFadden, they confront them with the evidence they have about all these women, but in particular about Tashanda Bathia and Sharon Nance. So they're questioning him, and he's resistant and doesn't know anything about it. What happens to make him confess?
I just think that the pressure of the investigation, plus all of his troubles, you know, he was under tremendous pressure. He needed money for drugs and all that. And the weight of all the killings on him, I think it just added up. He just got tired, you know, of playing this role. And he just opened up and he ended up talking for 10 hours, which I used a large part for my book, which were amazing. Mm-hmm. The trial records themselves were not available. I don't know what happened to them.
Mm.
And which made me kind of really worried, because I was saying, well, how was I going to do this book? How was I going to get into his mind and all that? Then I discovered these transcripts of the interviews with him. And that served as the basis for the book. But he reneged a little bit ways through the interviews. And he claimed that he had nothing to do with the murders and all that. But he talked and he really confessed to the murders. And then they tried to get the interviews thrown out of court when he went to trial. But the judge didn't go for it.
As you just mentioned, you use these details throughout the book to tell us what happened. Of course, for there was no eyewitness except Henry Wallace. So Henry Wallace tells us how he gains their trust, how they turned around, how he asked them for a glass of water, and then choked them, and then raped them, and told them, we're going to have this sex. And a couple of these friends cried, a couple people prayed, and there was no remorse from this person whatsoever. He wanted to have his sex. He wanted to have that crack. In fact, his last Deborah Slaughter, he left, sold some of her items for a certain amount of money, bought crack, and came back and smoked crack right near the body back in that apartment.
We went back and into the bathroom, past the body, and he did the drugs. And it was just quite amazing on that. And what makes a person like this? You know, I finished the book. I had no idea. I just knew that it was one of the most amazing stories that I ever read. And I said, there's got to be other people out there like that, that we don't know anything about. And I said, that's the chilling part about it.
You read about how careful he was to destroy DNA evidence. However, afterwards, and this seems incredible to the victims' families, I would imagine, is that the police had used rape kits to collect evidence in all the murders, except the results were missed in a massive backlog of evidence.
Exactly. There was, and finally, they got around to it. They checked the murders because, of course, they gave it a priority because of Wallace's arrest. And they found evidence connecting Wallace to the murders.
Yeah.
On that.
Yeah.
So this guy, you know, he got away with it all of his life. You know, he's always one step ahead of the law, it seemed, whether he was shoplifting, breaking into a store, or murdering a young woman on that. Now, all the victims, he was black and all the victims were black. And somebody asked, I mean, of course, did he do that because on the supposition that the police wouldn't be as interested in investigating the murders? And I don't think so. You know, there was just the people that he knew, and there was really nothing, you know, racial about the murders at all.
You write, you provide a statistic that was very interesting. I thought that the black population makes up 13%.
And 20% of what the black serial killers are black.
You were saying that actually 33% were black, where the population, they only represent 13%.
Yeah, so, right.
So a 33% is dramatic, especially given, like you write, the myth that all serial killers, or predominantly all serial killers, are white, where you say that's not the truth.
Exactly. And now there's an interesting part. They claimed that he was the first serial killer that knew all of his victims.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not usual for a serial killer to kill people they know.
Right.
And I had a woman on my radio show that had done a book on a serial killer named Jerry Marcus. And he was there. He had committed his crimes before Wallace. And he had actually known all the victims. And there were striking similarities in the cases between Marcus's case and Wallace's case. They were both gentlemen killers.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Now, you write about this trial, and of course, because of the 9... and, well, actually 10 murders that he's charged for, that the death penalty is on the table. And there has been some fight on the constitutionality of the death penalty, but at this time, the death penalty was still available for these murders?
Yeah, everybody thought that he was going to be put to death. He was going to be electrocuted. And the average time was about 9 years for somebody to go on death row and go through the appeals. Of course, they always appeal. And in this case, he exhausted his appeals by 2005, but he's still alive. And I understand that there was a moratorium put on the death penalty in North Carolina because of its controversy. And right now, no date has ever been set. And I asked, you know, people, I said, well, when is he going to be put to death? And the answer was, who knows?
Yeah. D. Sumter, you write, found out about the arrest from the news, and as did Henry's mother, Lottie May, and his sister, Yvonne, and they were shocked.
Yeah, the police never informed him, and I don't know if that was, if you could blame him for that, because, you know, there was so much activity going around the murders at that time, but you would think that they would inform the relatives of the dead people.
Yeah, you would think. So you write about how outraged the public was and critical of the police not making a connection through all that time, and also not warning anybody, but also they never made a connection to be able to warn anyone.
Yeah. It was only like about 3 days before they arrested Wallace that the cops even alerted the public in East Charlotte that there was possibly a serial killer in their midst. So they were out to lunch right up until the very end.
You talk about that spring soon after mothers of missing offspring asked the Charlotte City to investigate the police department.
Yeah, nothing really ever happened of that. Although the crime and all the controversies around it did help the police to finally get the resources it needed. It got technology that it needed. The number of police detectives was increased dramatically. I understand there are about 25 now investigating murders, and there were only seven at the time on that. And then they implemented some other policies too to better coordinate activities between law enforcement agencies. So it had a positive impact in the long run on Charlotte.
And also, Dee Sumter's organization that she founded would end up, and the police were agreeable with this, to work with the police department to help them, sensitivity training, and also especially in terms of how they would deal with the victims' families during an investigation.
Yeah. Heartening part of the story is that that there was a lot of friction between Gary McFadden and Dee Sumter, but they eventually ended up being friends. And according to Gary McFadden, he told me that, you know, they talk about once a week on that. Mm. But he was a good guy to have in that position. He was very community oriented, and he believed in talking to the people in the community, which was unlike the police in general in Charlotte at the time.
And Dee Sumter goes on to have an appearance on the famous talk show Donahue in Chicago.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, she had the trial, like, she did a good job keeping it in the public eye. You know what I mean?
Right.
And she's very articulate, very, very nice person. And she did a lot, I think, to publicize the crimes and help with its solution.
You say that this trial began 1996 after a 2-year delay. And of course, because this is a death penalty, there's a public defender and a qualified public defender ready to fight for this person to get off death row and to save them from the death penalty. And you have a defense counsel, Isabel Day and Jim Cooley, and Judge Hyatt at that time. And of course, the prosecutor is a person named Marcia Goodenow. And she is tenacious and very determined that this guy get the death penalty for these crimes.
Right. She did her job and achieved her objective on that. And Isabel Day was kind of an interesting woman. Wallace, after he was convicted and he was in prison, Central Prison in Raleigh, that's where he's now. And he ended up meeting a psychiatric nurse at the prison, a woman named Rebecca Torrios. And evidently they, you know, fell in love, and he married her.
Wow.
And Isabella Day was one of the witnesses at the wedding.
Wow.
And she was 23 years older than him. And she sort of disappeared off the face of the earth because she's not living in Raleigh or Charlotte. And I couldn't find her. It was a hard time trying to find her.
You talk about his life in prison. He didn't just stay quiet in prison, did he? There was some disciplinary problems.
Yeah, he played with a guard, locked him into a jail cell. Caroline Love's brother, who was up on a drug charge at the time, knowing that he had murdered his sister, picked a fight with him. And there was an altercation there, And there was supposed to be a fire in his cell that they thought that Wallace was involved with. So, yeah, so, you know, he did cause some serious problems on that. But he sort of disappeared. He doesn't really want to talk with anybody about it. I talked with the ABC producer. They did a special on the case for ABC, the news network. And I talked with the producer of that show. And she said, I said, why didn't you get Henry to interview? And he said, we tried, but he didn't want to talk to us. So I realized, I said, well, if he's not going to talk to her, he's not going to talk to me. And I said, I make better use of my time. So I decided not to pursue trying to get an interview with him because it would have been too time consuming. And I didn't think the chances were that good of getting it.
It's a foregone conclusion, but was the actual sentence January 2nd, 1997?
Well, he got convicted of all the murder charges and the rape charges. But the most important part is that he got the death sentence. You know, all the other stuff was gravy.
Now, as it is with many of these serial killers, did he gain notoriety behind prison walls? Were there people interested in him as a celebrity?
Well, I understand he's living in solitary pretty well most of the time. And he's protected like most prisoners like that. And I have not heard of any attempts on his life or any attempts to harm him at all. So he sort of like disappeared.
Interesting. And what did you get from this that you haven't gotten from many other true crime books and other books that you've written? You've written so many so far, and you've done your podcast for years now, your true crime podcast. Tell us what you got from this that you didn't find out or didn't determine something of value from this investigation in this book.
Well, this is the first book I did about a serial killer, which was kind of different. Usually the books I've done are on drug traffickers, you know,
right,
organized crime figures and stuff like this. It was quite a different, but I just couldn't believe that a guy like this could operate in society. And for 2 years, end up killing 10 women and nothing happens. I mean, he just gets away with it. You know, the police don't catch on and all that. And it just makes me wonder how many other guys are out there like that are operating now, that are actually smarter than Wallace, that didn't have a drug problem, didn't have his psychiatric problems, but are out there, you know, murdering women. And then when you look at the number of people that have disappeared, right, there's thousands of people. You say the odds of that happening are pretty good.
You talk about that. Well, in the introduction, we said that he's potentially responsible from anywhere from 20 to 90 deaths of black women.
They never proved that. I talked with Gary McFadden, and he said that that Wallace held that up. He sort of dangled that,
right,
that if he got a better sentence, that then maybe he would expose some of these crimes. But I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if Wallace ended up, you know, murdering a lot of, because they've done some checking, you know, in the Seattle area where he operated. Right. He was doing those crimes and all that, and they really haven't found anything that connects him to that. I mentioned the murders in Allendale. One woman named Riddle, she was murdered in her apartment. They thought that he may have something to do with that, but that never worked out. You know, they never able to prove anything on that. So I don't know if there are that many murders that he committed, like 20 to 90. I don't think so. To me, it would seem like very difficult to get away with it, you know, to do that many murders and get away with it. Especially when they know that you've killed 10 women already, you know, and they're looking for other cases.
Yes, absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Ron Chepsik, for coming on and talking about your latest, Bad Henry, The Murderous Rampage of the Taco Bell Strangler. For those that might want to find out more about your other work, you have a website and do social media?
Yeah, I got a website. It's www.ronchepsik, C-H-E-P-E-S-I-U-K. com.
Also, tell us about your podcast and what's new for you in writing.
Yeah, the podcast is Crime Beat, been in operation since 2011. We deal with all kinds of crime on that. We've had over 640 shows since our beginning. And as far as personal stuff, I'm working on a book on a Dallas con man in the oil and gas industry with a fellow producer, a film producer. And we're hoping to, we got the book contract with Wild Blue Press for that. And then once we finish the book, we're going to write a screenplay on it. And it'll be something like The Wolf of Wall Street.
Oh, very, very interesting.
Yeah.
We'll look forward to that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ron Chepsik, for Bad Henry, The Murderous Rampage of the Taco Bell Strangler. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening. Good night.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
Thank you.